Welcome to the Marine Mammal Science Podcast, the podcast for cutting-edge science and the latest conservation news about whales and dolphins, seals and sea lions, manatees, and other marine mammals.
Hello and welcome to the Marine Mammal Science Podcast. This is your host, Ashley Scarlett, and today I'm going to have two fantastic scientists joining me. We have Dr. Beth Brady, and we have our returning guest, Christy Ashley Collum. So Dr. Beth Brady has studied manatees for the past 13 years, and she works for the nonprofit Sirenian International, whose research focuses on manatees and dugongs. And our returning guest, Christy, is a lead researcher for Gotham Whale, and she is a critter spy. And we're here together because Christy mentioned something very interesting about manatees, which meant that we had to get our manatee expert, Dr. Beth Brady, to come and let's talk about the mysteries of manatees. And yeah, let's do some exploring too and talk about dugongs because she is an expert on this. And so yeah, let's say hello to our guests. Hello, Beth, and hello, Christy. Thank you so much for joining me. This is such an exciting delight to have you here. It was really hard to get you on the show together. You both are doing fantastic work. Every single time I tried to make an appointment with you guys, we had to cancel it because you had to go run off and save some marine mammals, which is definitely a perfect excuse to cancel on me. But I'm really excited to have you here on the show. And I just want to applaud you and say thank you so much for all the work that you're doing with all the critter rescues. So, Beth, where are you calling from?
I am calling from Pompano Beach, Florida, which is outside of Fort Lauderdale. So right now it's manatee-centric, because they're all coming down here to go to their warm water refuges.
Excellent. And Christy, we've had you on the show. Are you calling from outside again?
Yes, I'm calling out from the wilds of Brooklyn, New York again. Seeking my own refuge in the trees.
Bundled up still.
Yep.
Yeah. Excellent. We have Beth on here and Christy because we're going to be talking about manatees. And we'll talk about baby manatees and we'll talk about rescuing manatees. But before we do that, Beth, could you tell us some of your background? What's your story? Why are you studying manatees and dugongs?
Oh, well, thank you. So yeah, I started back in, 2007. So I always had this passion for marine mammal science, and I did a lot of volunteer work over the years. I volunteered at Clearwater Marine Aquarium. I actually volunteered with Winter the dolphin before she lost her tail. So that was really interesting. And then I decided that I wanted to do an internship. So I did a 9-month internship at Florida Fish and Wildlife in their photo identification program with manatees. And I absolutely loved it. Got a great experience there. And I still have the opportunity to volunteer with them today. So after that, I learned that manatees, you know, make vocalizations, but we didn't really know a whole lot about what manatees vocalize or how they use their vocalizations or even kind of vocalizations they create. So I went on to get my master's degree at Nova Southeastern University and then continued on to Florida Atlantic University, where I finally finished my PhD this past year in 2020. So 2020 is not all bad, right? But yeah, my research focused on vocalizations of the Florida manatee. And I also looked at vocalizations in adults and calves and associated with behavior, as long as categorizing some of the vocalizations that manatees make.
And so right now, what are you doing? And I every single time I keep talking to you, even today, you were about to do a manatee rescue. Could you tell us a little bit about your work right now?
So sure. So I'm lucky to be able to volunteer my off time with Florida Fish and Wildlife. They do some amazing rescues. They're like a well-oiled machine when they do their rescues. It's such a privilege to be able to go out with them and be able to rescue manatees. And last week I went out with the group from Tequesta, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Office there, and we rescued two male manatees that unfortunately were hit by boats, which is a big problem here in Florida, that they do tend to be hit by boats a lot and they've sustained a lot of injuries. So yeah, I got to go out and help rescue those, which was great fun, but also help to save these mammals.
Could you tell us a few facts that, you know, you find so spectacular and so interesting about manatees and dugongs?
That's really hard. There's a lot. So most people don't know about dugongs, right? So dugongs are actually over in the Indo-Pacific. They have a tail like a dolphin and a more downward facing snout. And they actually used to live over in this area and they went extinct about 2.5 million years ago, which is fascinating. So dugongs were in our area and now they're over in the Indo-Pacific. But the really thing I find fascinating about dugongs is their feeding strategy. So since they have this more downward facing snout, it means they can only feed at the bottom of the water column and they pull out the plants by the root and tend to shake them. And there's some interesting work done by Ahmed Baki of the Egyptian dugong. He actually looks at their feeding trails. So when they lift up these plants, they leave feeding trails. And he actually looks at the width of these feeding trails and he can tell whether or not it's an adult or a juvenile by the size and the width of these feeding trails, which I find absolutely fascinating.
That's really quite interesting. I do want to touch back on some of your rescue experience. I was wondering, what is the procedure of rescuing a manatee or a dugong?
Ooh. So I think Florida Fish and Wildlife would probably do this and talk about this a lot better than I, but I will do my best. So what they do is they usually get calls from the public about an injured manatee. First, they usually send out someone, I think, to observe and make sure that, it is an injured manatee. Sometimes they get phone calls and the animal is just resting or doing something that a manatee normally does. But when they do go out and get a manatee, they have to first assess whether or not they're going to do it from a boat or if they can do it from land. I've been to some captures where we actually put a net across and tried to capture them with just a net from land. And then last week we went out on a boat. So I went out with Amber Howell. She's so good at doing these. What they do is they encircle the manatee in a net and then they bring the manatee on board, which takes about 6 to 7 people to do. And then we'll take it to shore, but they usually find the animal and then try to enclose it in a net. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes not so easy. I guess it depends on the number of other animals in the area. So they have to kind of separate and isolate that animal from the others to be able to capture it. And I believe there was a rescue that they had done about a week ago where Monica Ross from Clearwater Marine Aquarium actually had to separate and isolate one of the animals because there were so many animals in the warm water refuge. And she's helped a lot, I know, with their rescues as well.
You know, everyone's talking about the polar vortex that was coming down and affecting a lot of states. You know, it made us really cold here in Tampa. And so I was just wondering, like, how badly does that affect our Florida manatees?
So that's really interesting. And I think we don't have, I know it gets below 68 degrees Fahrenheit. They do not tolerate the cold water for long periods of time. How long that is, I'm not quite sure. For calves, it's going to be different because they're smaller in size. They have a small surface to area ratio. So they're going to be more affected than a larger adult. From what I gather, I think it could be a couple of days. I think that they can tolerate it before they start to show signs of what we call cold stress or something that's similar to frostbite. The interesting thing about manatees is they tend to go out at night to forage, to feed, and come back during the day, which I usually think is the coldest part of the day. But I think that's the time that they tend to go out and feed is at night. I'm thinking maybe it has to do with the warming of the water, so it doesn't cool down, I guess, till the early morning. And so they're coming back into the warm water refuges during the day, staying warm all day, and then going out at night. But it's really fascinating behavior.
Oh my gosh, that's really incredibly fascinating. I didn't even know that. So you were mentioning a little bit before we started recording about the long distance that they actually travel. I was wondering if you could kind of go more into detail about that.
Sure, there's been some tracking studies. Again, there's been a lot of that work done, I believe, through Florida Fish and Wildlife as well. And they actually have tracked, United States Geological Survey, Sovereignia Project has done a lot of tracking of individuals and seeing where they go. So they normally have what they call subpopulations of Florida manatees, where they tend to travel to the similar warm water refuges and similar summertime refuges. So in general, they have, I believe it's the Atlantic population, a Blue Springs or St. John's River population, Southwest Florida, and then in the northern area, they tend to go to the similar, tend to stay in the same similar areas. But there are some animals that have gone some rather lengthy distances. I believe there has been one from Crystal River, which is on the in the middle of the west coast of Florida, traveled from there to Cuba. There was one named Chessie, I believe, went all the way up from Florida to Massachusetts. And I actually think there was one that crossed this a couple of years ago from, I believe it was Crystal River to the Bahamas. So this is, you know, not, they would travel a lot further than they actually, you know, think that they would.
Yeah, especially how slow they are. I couldn't even imagine how long it takes them to go from here to Massachusetts or even here to the Bahamas. I couldn't even imagine that. Yeah, that just makes me want to dive more into the research, but I can't do that. But that's what you guys are here for. And so it makes it really interesting to talk about, like, we're talking about the temperatures, right? That they're very sensitive to the temperatures, but then here they are going up north. And this is why we have Christy here on this call, because Christy works in New York City. And Christy, you see manatees over there.
Yes, it's not at all common, but as Beth mentioned, Chessie was one of the manatees that was actually up in New York Harbor as well. And Ilya, some folks might remember, I think it was 2009, that traveled up to New York in October. And as Beth mentioned, you know, they don't do well in cold water. And even though they look like these chubby, wonderful floating potatoes, they are actually very, very insulated with minimal fat, and they have a low metabolic rate. Most of their body, that size, that width that makes them so bulbous, is from their intestines and their stomach mostly. So they really aren't found in waters usually as warm as 60 degrees, I believe, Beth. She's better to give the stats on where they do best. But I just found it so fascinating. And it sounds like, you know, it is rare that they are found here up north, but it seems that they do navigate this far. And just thinking about how slow they move and the risks that they face. I mean, humans are one of their top predators. They really don't have many natural predators in the waters that they're found in and in Florida and other coveted spaces that, you know, they also like to have these kind of secret spots, which I find fascinating, having resting holes or kind of like cloaking to a bay, staying in some freshwater and marine habitats. So it's really strange just to think of a manatee like Ilya coming and making a 1,300-mile journey to New York. Why? And that's something that I hope that we can answer. And one of the things I find so interesting about the work that Beth does, and I'm so excited to be collaborating and learning from her, is that there's so little that the world knows about manatees and dugongs. You know, they're really just a mystery still to us, and we want to make sure that they don't become a legend in themselves, as many of the other extinct Sirenians now are.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, no, I completely agree. When you guys are telling me all this information, I'm like, I had no idea. Yeah. Beth, would you like to add anything to this?
I think Christy covered it rather well. So it's, yeah, I think the main question is, why are they going that far? So from the tagging studies that I've read, the males and the females tend to travel the furthest outside of their range. And those are some of the animals, I believe, I think if I'm correct, that they documented going these rather lengthy distances. So, but it's quite unclear why would they go that far. The fascinating thing about these animals is they have smooth brains. And I had read this thing about, and I love science, about how koalas also had smooth brains, and they thought that they were, you know, not intelligent. But I think manatees are quite intelligent, even with a smooth brain, because they have these phenomenal memories to remember, where do I go for my warm water refuge? Where do I go to get food? And if they can travel these long distances and still get back to their warm water refuge, how do they do that? Right. And they have these, like I said, these amazing memories, just like elephants, and they are related to elephants. So just like elephants, they have these amazing memories to remember. Like I said, where do they go? And the reason is, but we still want to know, like, why there? Why do you travel this far what purpose is behind it?
Yeah. And Christy, I was wondering if you could add to that. And also if you could tell us a little bit about, if you know more about the two manatees that you mentioned, Ilya and
Chessie. Yes. So I, in New York, I also have been doing a rescue and working with as a volunteer, just like Beth, just to be able to help in any strandings or any entanglements that I can. And really, it's just, there's so much that you can learn from the people that do this full time. It's astounding. They must never tire. And working with the Atlantic Marine Conservation Society, I met a few colleagues of mine have already worked with them, the Marine Mammal Stranding Center in New Jersey. And so that's not necessarily my native habitat. I don't find myself in New Jersey as often as I'd like to, but they respond to even the smallest incident that they can, these organizations, just to be able to kind of ground truth whatever's going on. If someone says, oh, there's a marine mammal that's out on the beach and it can't breathe, I'm so scared, and it turns out to be a seal, it's really disappointing because they haul out and it's normal, and you know, it's typical behavior. And I think that's why outreach is so important, and sharing this information and these rare stories. And the Marine Mammal Stranding Center, when they had a manatee last year, I contacted Troy Platt, who has been in communication with me, and we've talked about possibly doing some work on their data to be able to talk about their sightings of manatees and other rare, uncommon species in New York to better substantiate, you know, and have some kind of pattern as to why these uncommon occurrences are happening and if there's any implication for it, or simply just to share that information with the public as well as scientists that are working in coastal ecosystems. And they actually had postulated that manatees probably are seen here at least every year, not necessarily the same time of year, not necessarily at risk coming in the winter months, but it's not uncommon to them to hear that there's a manatee in New York. And I found that fascinating because it certainly was news to me.
Yeah, clueless. I had no idea. But yeah, the fact that they came and you saw them in October makes me worry about how cold it was. I mean,
there's been people that have known to feed them in certain areas. And this is just anecdotal conversation from different people in Long Island and as well as in Cape Cod, saying that they would go and they'd feed manatees even in the summertime. Like, what? There aren't supposed to be manatees there. It's strange.
Now, that's an interesting point, Christy, because manatees are mostly, you know, they're herbivores. They'll eat opportunistically other things. But I don't recall there being seagrass beds, which is their main food source up in New York. So what do you think they're feeding on when they're up there? That would be my question.
I'm imagining the iceberg lettuce that people are feeding them. I know that kelp was one of the possible items that they'd eaten, and that I know that other, like the Stellar Sea Cow, I think fed primarily in kelp, but I don't know. Yeah, I wouldn't dare guess. But these mysteries have to be solved.
Yeah, I completely agree with both of you guys. Like, I didn't realize there was so much for us to learn and that we don't know about manatees, dugongs. This is incredible. And so, like, when people want to get more involved or to contribute to more science research on these topics, where would they go?
Well, there is an app, I believe, right, Beth, with the MREC. And you can actually, it's a citizen science app to be able to track your manatee sightings. And so that's one way that people can contribute.
Yeah, I believe there's one there. There's also one for Broward College. Broward County, my apologies, has an I Spy a Manatee app, but it's just for Broward County. I also think there is through the Seta Lingua Project, you can actually go in there and identify manatee vocalizations if you choose to. So there's a citizen science project doing that. If you're actually near any of the aquariums where they have manatees, there's a rehab facility up in Jacksonville, one in since I think there's one or two in Cincinnati in Ohio. You might be able to assist your time there or Jacksonville, or even at some of the power plants. They might need help and such, possibly.
Yeah. And volunteering to help in your coastal habitat always. I mean, even if you're not a scientist, you know, even those of us that are trying to make a career in marine science, like volunteering is just helpful for the world, for the animals and your experience. It's phenomenal just to be able to see how these people can save the lives of animals, or at least try to. And it's just a really rewarding experience.
Yes, I love that. That's awesome. Okay, so here we are. It's time to start sharing our stories. So I know Christy for sure has a story about a manatee, a baby manatee. So Christy, could you please share your most memorable story and tell us about this sweet little baby?
Well, that's actually how I started working with Beth, which is really exciting. I actually met Beth on a manatee assessment in Crystal River, and it was my first time ever working in rescue with manatees, and actually the first time ever touching a manatee, since of course we should never touch wildlife. But in these circumstances, you have to, so that the veterinarians can examine them, and you use a sonogram to be able to look into their bellies and see if they do have a calf, or that everything is working as it should. And it was just so amazing to see how strong and massive they were, as well as their development and the structure of their vibrissae and their snout. And so I was really interested in working with manatee acoustics. I've worked with acoustics with dolphins and whales, as we talked about before, but I've also in the last 2 or 3 years started working on Antillia manatee vocalizations. And Beth had a project that she wanted to work on with some of our colleagues, and I was lucky enough to be able to learn from her expertise and start looking at the calf calls of Antillia manatees. And she can speak to the more specifics about that. But I just found it so interesting how different the call structure of the calves were, and how they were even variable between individuals, which is one of Beth's questions, to be able to try and explain those differences. But really, just as we're learning to talk, you think about a baby babbling. It's so amazing to be able to hear manatees in their baby babble development of communication.
Oh my God, how precious. Okay, Beth, you must tell us all about it.
Okay, so yeah, some of this research is still in its infancy, but I got the opportunity to record some captive calves at Zoo Tampa. So if you get some orphan calves or mothers that were hit by boats, they bring in their calf as well when they rescue the mom. So I got the opportunity there to record some sounds from some individual calves, and also we had the fortunate experience to record some calves in the wild. And what we're looking at is how their vocalizations change as they age. So there's been some prior research done on this by Renata Suzalima and Tom O'Shea, who looked at the structure of the vocalization. And from what we're gathering, and we still need a lot more data gathering to really confirm this, what we're seeing is that the calf tends to make this hill-shaped call. And as they get older, it starts to flatten out and become a more linear or a more adult type call. Now, this is really important. We're starting to see this across West Indian manatee species, which is in the Antillean and the Florida. And then we also have some indications that this also may be true in Amazonian manatee species. So that's really important, right? So that looks like is similar across all species. Not one, you can detect it, even if you can't visually see the animal, and you may be able to differentiate whether or not it's a calf or an adult.
Ooh, okay. So I need to know, do you find this when you're looking at dugongs too?
So we don't have any calls from dugongs that I'm aware of from calves, right? So that's still something that needs to be explored. We also don't know about African manatee vocalizations either. But from what I understand about dugongs, their vocalizations are somewhat similar. They have a little bit of variation in between dugongs and manatees. They do vary slightly. I would love to record some baby dugongs. But as far as I know, and I'm still questioning if anyone out there knows of any dugong rehab facilities where they have dugongs, I'm not familiar with any myself, but if anyone does, please contact me. I would love to come to your facility.
Okay. And what is your contact information if they're listening right now?
biobbrady@gmail.com. And I can forward that information to you, Ashley, if needed.
Excellent. Fantastic. And so, Christy, do you have any last thoughts?
Well, I wonder if anyone knows what a manatee sounds like. And I am not the best vocal imitator, but I just was so interested to hear the calls of the manatees, the squeaks that they make, the and in the calls of these manatee calves, I had labeled some for Beth to review that I called squeal howls, because they were kind of like a and I was so interested to think about, you know, how the calls look in the spectrogram. You know, so many animal vocalizations look similar in structure, but when you hear them, you know, it's so different, so unique to them. So just wanted to make sure that we gave some kind of manatee imitation.
Yeah, I love the thank you so much. And I'm wondering, Beth, did you want to contribute in that imitation?
People always ask me this, and by all means, I'm going to send you some clips so you can put that into the podcast.
That's even better. They can compare.
It was like, that's what I always think they sound like a high-pitched squeak. They almost sound, people are like, that sounds like a rat or a bird. I'm like, right? It's something that's very high-pitched that people don't expect coming from such a large animal. But yeah, I'll definitely send you some recordings that you can put into the podcast.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. Oh my gosh, this has been fantastic. I've enjoyed this conversation. I love manatees and dugongs right now. I think they're just so magical. And I think that's what we're definitely titling this episode.
The True Mermaids.
How can people get a hold of you guys? So we'll start with Beth.
So yeah, my email is bio, B-I-O-B. Brady. So biobbrady@gmail.com. And I'm happy to answer any emails or any questions anyone has. I'm happy to also collaborate.
Are you on social media?
I am. I do have a small nonprofit called Sirenian International. So they can also go there as well. There is a group within the public page that is more scientist focused. There's a lot of scientists on there. So by all means, come join that and help us continue that conversation. It's a place we can all share our research and what we're doing. I'm always happy to share what anyone else is doing in the field as well.
Excellent. Thank you. And Christy?
Yeah. Well, you can contact me via email, ChristyAshleyCollum@gmail.com, but definitely on Facebook. Great way for us to all interconnect. Follow Sirenian International on Facebook. Beth is really great at sharing just wonderful fun facts about manatees and important information. And yeah, feel free to add me on Facebook, strangers.
So thank you so much, Beth and Christy, for being on this show. And for all you listeners, thank you for listening.
This was the Marine Mammal Science Podcast. The editor and producer is Dr. Ashley Scarlett. This podcast is produced by the Speak Up for Blue Network on behalf of the Society for Marine Mammalogy. The theme music was by Kevin McLeod of Incomp Tech.